This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Naomi Wolf about what it's like to be in Guantanamo under the Obama administration.
It's a sad and awful story from beginning to end. Naomi finally, after many years, got to visit Guantanamo. The improvements we'd hoped for under President Obama have not occurred. Perhaps it's even worse.
In what has to be one of the most shameful acts of the Obama administration, we'll hear the story of Mohammed Jawad, a boy who was picked up at the age of 12 and has been detained ever since.
Despite the fact that he was tortured over many of the 7 long years and that there's no evidence to hold him, the Obama administration, I almost said Bush administration, continues to keep him jailed.
Stay with us.
Recently, Naomi Wolf, author of this amazing book, The End of America, went down to see firsthand what Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, was like. Well, she got to the base. She never got to see a person detained there, never got to talk to one, never got to even talk to the lawyers at the base. She described it as a tour in which she was kept in a cocoon, essentially. But despite that, she has some amazing observations on Guantanamo and whether or not Obama's promise to make it better, to close it, etc., is one that we are seeing at all. So today we're happy to have with us Naomi Wolf, author of an amazing article also called Guantanamo Bay, The Inside Story. Naomi Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So Naomi, I've been reading a number of your recent pieces, one called Guantanamo Bay, The Inside Story, which is about a relatively recent trip that you took to Guantanamo as a journalist. So why don't you just begin with laying the framework for us? Why'd you go there, and what was it like getting there?
Yeah, well, I've been following what was going on in Guantanamo for several years since I began doing research for a book I wrote called The End of America, which you and I and Michael have talked about before on this show. And key piece of the argument is that you need secret prisons or prisons outside the rule of law where torture takes place in order to create a police state, essentially, or in order to close down an open society. You can't do it without that. And my argument was that the torture at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo and in black sites around the world was not the work of a few bad apples. It was clear really early on, and of course, you know, we all know this to be true now, but that it was systemic. For exactly this reason, it was a policy, a matter of policy. And I've been admiring the work of people at the Center for Constitutional Rights and, you know, Michael and his colleagues for many years as well, because they were at the forefront, and they are at the forefront of this fight. And so it occurred to me in about January of this year that I've been following this so closely. We've got a new president. You know, I write about it all the time. I should go down and see it for myself and judge for myself if anything has changed under an Obama administration. So I got in line, basically, and I applied for journalistic clearance. I wanted to follow a CCR, a Center for Constitutional Rights lawyer doing, you know, what he or she does down there with his or her clients. Of course, that's illegal. You're not allowed. Journalists are kind of rigidly isolated from lawyers.
That was actually interesting in your article, because you said on the plane down you were with Pardis from the center, as well as Jessica, who is one of our paralegals. And you were able to talk to them on the plane, but as soon as you got off the plane, what happened?
It was like, the Soviet Union in 1948. I mean, we got off the plane together and we were talking, and my media handler, MC1 Map, immediately separated me from Pardis and barely let her give me her card. And I said, well, will I be able to speak to her while I'm here? And he basically said, no. You know, not only are they kept in two separate kinds of compounds, you know, one on the windward side of the island, one on the leeward, but you're literally not able to, there's no neutral place where you can, you know, where journalists can view the lawyers at work, talk to the lawyers at work. In fact, journalists are literally shadowed every minute that they're there. It's really like being in a police state.
It's like a what? Say that again, Naomi?
I said it's like being in a police state. You can't get internet access. Your BlackBerry doesn't work. You can't phone out without the line being not private, presumably. And yeah, you literally can't do any reporting. So that was the beginning of the journey. Some of the other things I found there were, you know, just as profound. But it's clear that one reason the last administration, now this one, was able and is able to lie to the American people about what's going on down there so successfully is that not only do they keep lawyers from doing their jobs, but they keep journalists from doing their jobs.
Now, I presume in addition to not being able to see the lawyers or talk to the lawyers when you were there, you were likewise not able to talk to any of the detainees. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. They literally treat them like animals in a cage, you know, animals that you can't even get close enough to communicate with. I mean, they literally bring you to view them, like through, you know, through a glass darkly, like view them like it's an aquarium or like it's a, you know, a slave auction is really what it made me think of. But anything that would humanize them, any interaction is categorically forbidden. And there's this very, to me, very heartbreaking moment in my piece where, you know, some of the detainees caught a glimpse of this small group of journalists and started shouting at us. And I heard it as go. You know, when we got out of their line of sight, I asked my handler, why are they telling us to go? And he said, no, they, you know, they've learned English slang. They're saying, yo, they're trying to get your attention. But there was actually a Uyghur protest the day, I think actually the day we were there, and we were not allowed, we weren't told about it, we were not allowed to view it. And I happened to sit next to one of the lawyers for one of the Uyghurs. These are gentlemen from China who are, you know, who've been, who've never had charges filed against them, as I understand. They've been mostly cleared for release, and some of them have been released. And he said, and I said, could I talk to them? Had I, you know, had I been able to get to them when I was there? And he said, no, they speak, some of them speak English. They, you know, they're holding up signs in English, but they won't let journalists walk up and have a conversation with them. It's extraordinary.
No, it is extraordinary. And I thought some of the other details, and then I want to go to some of the bigger pieces I read in your article. But the way showers are taken, the way the camps are set up, can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. First, they showed us Camp X-Ray, which is, you know, your listeners may remember in the early years of Guantanamo, we would often see, again, from far away, because they didn't let journalists very close at all, pictures of what looked like dog kennels and human beings in dog kennels. And this was Camp X-Ray. And it was so extraordinary that they really took us right inside. It's being overgrown. Nature's reclaiming it. But what you see are 8 by 8 foot cells, maybe 40 or 50 of them, totally exposed to 100 degree heat, to, you know, blistering sun, no shelter, and climbing around you are these rats the size of bulldogs. I am not kidding. They're called banana rats.
I know. And I read that in your piece, and I'd been to Guantanamo years ago, and I maybe had seen one of them along. I barely remember it. But that description of you're seeing a banana rat, it was like, it's scary. I mean, you just see those huge animals.
Yeah, it's creepy enough, you know, when you can get away into a vehicle or into, you know, your housing. But you just really imagine, you know, being a human being locked up in a cage with these gigantic mammals, you know, scurrying around you like in the middle of the night. It's just so, how can I put it? It was just one of those kind of transcends language because it's so gothic. It's so like the depth of evil that people would think, okay, well, we'll just, you know, house human beings here. But what was a couple of things that were very striking about Camp X-Ray, and I wonder, Michael, if it's changed, I mean, it must have changed significantly since you were there. Do you remember Camp X-Ray when it was up and running, Michael?
I only saw the pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They keep journalists and photographers when they kept you hundreds of meters away. But one thing that struck me was, you know, the way it was all open to the elements. And then they took us into the interrogation room, and it's like they've inherited a gulag, you know, because most of them are new faces, and they haven't really worked out the kinks yet. So I noticed that there was a wasp nest suspended from the ceiling where, you know, clearly some poor prisoner had been, I'm assuming, you know, locked in, and they let the wasp nest go. I can't imagine what else it would have been for.
No, that makes sense, especially, and they're shackled to the floor and to the chair. So you're sitting with a wasp's nest right in that room. That's pretty scary.
And then, Michael, I wonder what, you know, what you would say about this. I went into another room, and there was like, honestly, it was like a horror movie. There was a huge pile of very elaborate chairs, and I looked closely at the arms and legs, and there were like duct tape marks, as if duct tape had been wrapped tightly around where the ankles and wrists of someone sitting there would be, and they were intensely abraded at the ankles and at the hands, and they were piled up. And I asked, and the media handler kept saying, "This place is being left alone. and untouched because of a media petition to leave it alone for history. And finally, when I pressed him long enough, he admitted that it was a legal injunction that some rights organization, maybe yours, had asked that this be legally, it had to be left alone because it was a crime scene, and someday in the future the detainees presumably can, you know, bring charges for how they were treated there.
Partly, Naomi, there's been motions by the lawyers in Guantanamo Center and many of the other lawyers, to preserve the evidence for their own cases so they can demonstrate how their clients were treated in these conditions. But I thought your duct tape detail in the article was really telling. I mean, that was scary. When you think about people taped to chairs for hours and hours and days, probably, and having to, you know, actually getting the metal on the chair is worn away.
If it's a legal injunction to leave it alone, isn't it illegal that it's open to the elements and that people like journalists can tramp through and handle things at will? I mean, aren't you supposed to, like...
It's a good question, Naomi. I'm going to have to find out more now that you've raised it in that context, because we don't know exactly what's going on with all of that. I mean, there are legal requirements that some of those places have to be kept open, but I want to make sure which ones before I come make a comment on that particular one.
I see. Well, it was extremely terrifying. And the other terrifying thing was that this poor guy who was tasked with, you know, handling us had been fed this stream of lies by the media team. They're just flat-out lies. Like, he told us that the interrogation cell, which was modeled on Stalin's gulag, all of the gulag units had an interrogation cell.
And that's remarkable.
Like one of the most terrifying things. Yeah.
Because, as you know,
better than I, you know, isolation is more crippling to prisoners often than physical torture. But this guy had to tell us that the isolation cell came into being because other prisoners were disturbed by unruly fellow prisoners and asked that there be an isolation cell for the prisoners.
Yeah, you believe that, you'll buy the Brooklyn Bridge from me, Naomi.
Exactly.
The United States government spent lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, researching what would be the most effective kind of torture. And they found out what was called touchless torture, which is sensory deprivation. And as you say, that was even more damaging to the human spirit than any kind of physical torture.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. It was clear that the Obama team down there wanted to communicate that there's a kinder, gentler Guantanamo. And what was clear to me is that some of the stuff happening there is even scarier in a way because it's being marketed as all better now. But in fact, some hideous stuff is happening. You asked about the other facilities. And so after Camp X-Ray, we went to Camps 4, 5, and 6, which are for, quote, high-value detainees, which your lawyer, Wells Dixon, pointed out to me is a pejorative term. It, you know, presumes that these people are something whereas they haven't had their day in court. And this was state-of-the-art, a medium-security prison and a high-secure maximum-security prison. And, you know, they were showing off it got so surreal, the love seat where compliant teenies get shackled to the floor to, you know, watch Harry Potter on a widescreen television and have their dinner on a tray.
You mean they're shackled to the floor while they're watching the TV?
Exactly.
What a great image of modern America.
That was creepy again and again. It was like this sort of, still torture. It was still detention without recourse to due process. But they were putting a happy face on it. And like later, they showed us a medical bay and this scary smiling nurse. I mean, scary because she was smiling in a way. Showed us this display of Ensure, which is, you know, this liquid that you give people who are dehydrated or who can't eat. It was about hunger strikes. And I had known from your lawyers, Michael, that there were 30 hunger strikers at Guantanamo.
This is a very important part of your article, Naomi. And I just want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Naomi Wolf, the author of many books, but the one that we are most in touch with her about is The End of America. And she's written a very important piece in the London Times, Guantanamo Bay, the inside story. Naomi, how can people, before you go to the next phase of Ensure, how can people get access to the articles?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, you can go to the London Times UK website, or you could go to my website, and it's called, Guantanamo Bay, the inside story.
Great. Now, Naomi, go ahead, because this was an extraordinary part of your article, meeting the nurse who talks to you about Ensure, and what happens in this conversation?
You know, as a Jew, and as anyone who's interested in the human condition, but certainly my own family background of having ancestors who died in the Holocaust, part of me has always wondered how great evil can be brought about among ordinary people. I really got the answer to that in my trip to Guantanamo. And the other thing is, this is news because I think something newsworthily appalling happened when I was there. She showed us this, and I'll get to exactly what, she showed us this display of insurance. She said, oh, look, you know, they can choose banana nut, they can choose French vanilla, they can choose hazelnut, mocha. We give them a choice. And she sort of made it seem like force feeding with a tube down your throat was, you know, she said, our commander, you know, went on a liquid diet and he gained 4 pounds. And I said, you know, was he restrained? I mean, it was just so surreal. And subsequently, we found out why they gave us this elaborate display. At that time, also, there was a psychologist there, and neither of these people would identify themselves, which is also very scary to me, because there's no recourse. And all the contractors there don't have to identify themselves. They don't have to answer your questions, and it's about 60, 40 contractors. So the next day, the psychologist, I kept pressing him, do you report crimes that your clients confide to you that have been committed against them? And he really tried to kind of weasel out of it, but he finally confirmed that, you know, no, he'll tell his colleagues, but he won't file a formal report, which, as I understand the Geneva Conventions, is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And he got very defensive. It's also unethical, according to the American Psychological Association. But I found out the next morning why we had this bizarre display. A friend of mine had happened to send me a little piece about a guy named Mohammed Al-Hanashi, a 34-year-old Yemenite prisoner who had allegedly committed suicide at Guantanamo right then, like the day before. And it was a very terse press release. There were no details, really. And I wasn't supposed to receive that because we didn't have any internet access anywhere, but I happened to kind of catch a tiny thread of internet access that was floating around in the backyard.
I was here when that suicide happened, and you had no way. You were more isolated in Guantanamo, even though the suicide, or supposed suicide, I don't want to say suicide, because we don't know yet. When that happened, you were completely isolated and had no way of knowing about that while you were in Guantanamo.
Every journalist in the world who's interested in this knew about it, and those of us who were questioning the top brass in Guantanamo, who were dealing with this death, about things like deaths of prisoners, direct questions, we were not informed about it, and they were trying to keep us uninformed.
And instead, they give you a display of the various flavors of Ensure to say, this is how nicely we're treating people. Anyway, go ahead now.
Freud would have had a field day. This is what I mean about the banality of evil. Yeah. They were clearly uneasy, and it was like bizarre. It was like overkill. Why are you showing us this? But someone had died on their watch, and it had probably been that nurse and that psychologist who had just been dealing with the death in this bizarre projection. They were saying, look how nice we are. But what happened concretely was our handlers were aware that we had gotten hold of the story, and oh, how odd, the van developed a flat tire and we couldn't go anywhere.
No, really?
The day we were stuck, this magical flat tire appeared out of nowhere. And in a multi-billion-dollar naval base, there wasn't one set of tools or one other van to get us out of there. So we were literally marooned. It was like being journalists in the Soviet Union before the fall of the Berlin Wall. There was no way to do our jobs. And finally, when we got up and running, they never told us anymore, even though I asked a lot of direct questions. Subsequently, I discovered, very disturbingly, that Al-Hanashi was the detainee's elected representative, meaning that he knew where all the bodies were buried. He knew where, you know, who had been tortured according to them, how they had been tortured according to them, every misdeed. So January 17th, 3 days before the new boss is due to come in, Al-Hanashi gets called to a meeting with the top brass, the admiral and the head of the guard force, and he never goes back to his cell. After that meeting, he goes straight to the psych ward. They take him straight to the psych ward, and he dies, until he dies. And that was the story, except that Binyam Mohammed, who has since been released, who knew him, told the Associated Press that he was not suicidal, that he was the kind of guy who would never kill himself. And frankly, you know, when I've been pushing Brooke DeWalt, Lieutenant Commander Brooke DeWalt, who's the head of the media team there, to give me some answers about this alleged suicide, I've been saying to him things like, look, I've seen those cells. it is impossible to kill yourself in those cells. Literally, it's like the inside of a, you know, of a milk carton. There's nothing. There are no hooks. The hooks fold down. There are no sharp edges. There's, you know, you can't do it. And you know, I suppose you could bang your head against a wall, but I happened to be sitting next to the doctor on the military transport who investigated the death, and he confided to me that they check them every 3 minutes. So you can't kill yourself in those cells. And he won't give me answers. He won't give me answers. But Al Jazeera just reported 2 days ago that apparently he died from asphyxiation, and they're still waiting for the coroner's report 7 weeks after the death.
Yes. Yemen apparently is the one that has made that accusation that he died from asphyxiation.
Oh, really? And so what would they be basing that on?
I don't know. They must have gotten some report somewhere. I don't know where that's from. That's a good question, Naomi.
I'm a layperson watching this, and if I was reading it in a novel or a thriller, I'd think, well, that certainly bears further investigation. Because, you know, the situation is the military is investigating itself. Again, as I understand the Geneva Convention, it's supposed to file a death report, and they have not done so with independent body. What should your listeners make of this? What should I make of this?
Well, what we should make of it is that we've had, quote, suicides before. In two of those cases, the Center for Constitutional Rights is representing the families in lawsuits against the officials at Guantanamo and others. We don't accept that they were suicides or deaths that could have been avoided, and I think it's going to be likewise in this case. One problem, of course, is that to the extent some people may know more than you and I know here, the lawyer for various people, is they can't talk to anybody because they're all under orders that everything is national security. So even I, there may be a lawyer or two in my office who knows more. I don't know that, but they can't even talk to me. So it's completely extraordinary, wrapped up situation. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah. Michael, can I just interject and explain to your listeners who are not lawyers this whole classified thing? Because it blew my mind, and it's a giant takeaway for everybody who cares about justice. It's incredible. There's so much people don't know about what happened to these detainees and who they are because, and correct me if I'm wrong, everything that could explain who they are, explain what they were doing, where they were, you know, taken in, explain how their confessions were tortured out of them, is classified. And not only that, but your very brilliant and wonderful lawyer, Wells Dixon, explained to me that the actual torture committed against them has been called sources and methods that are classified. So their bodies are crime scenes, but they can't talk about what happened to them because what happened to them is classified, right?
No, you got it exactly right. Even like Wells's clients or Gita's or any of them, Pardis's, the fact that they were tortured at all, the manner in which they were tortured is completely classified and only they know it. And that's why they have to write all their briefs, all the legal papers are written out of a secret facility in Washington, a closed facility, where there's no internet access at all because they don't want any information getting out. Everything goes through censors. I mean, it's completely and utterly bizarre and awful, and I think you're giving us a good description of it.
It goes beyond. I really want to kind of communicate what this does to everybody out there because we're so used to living in a free society, which means that I can tell you things, you know, or the lawyer can tell you things in his client's defense, if that's permissible. But like Wells made it clear to me, he had to read the article before it went to press because not that he doesn't believe in free speech, but because if anything slipped out that was classified, he could get prosecuted and I could get prosecuted. I mean, it's one thing if it really is a matter of national security, but this is like the crimes that have been committed against these guys are classified, therefore the American people can't know about them. I mean, like deliberately, it's like if the Nazis, you know, let people out of concentration camps but said you can't ever tell anyone what happened to you, and your lawyers can't, you know, the people at the Nuremberg trials can't talk about what happened to you, I mean, we would have a completely different view of history. And so there's this giant thing happening that we can't even know about because there are these circles of silence that have been placed around them. For example, what happened to Al-Hanashi? There was a lawyer named Elizabeth Gilson who probably knows what happened to Al-Hanashi because one of her clients was in the psych ward with him. But she can't talk about it because it's classified.
Exactly.
And so I guess, you know, just meeting these people, I've never run into this before. Like, there is, it's like the mafia. It's like Omerta, you know, like.
That's a good example.
Naomi Wolf, you talked about this as, in your opinion, a really question of policy, that there's continuity between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. If the Obama administration is trying to say, Gitmo, it's all better now, and you characterize that as just a piece of marketing. Stepping back, what's your overall take on why this is going on, and secondly, what can we do about it?
Well, I was going to ask you what we can do about it, but I can tell you why I think it's going on. My best understanding is that so many people up and down the chain of command were either overtly complicit or tacitly complicit in very grievous torture, that Obama, if he were to let justice be done and let these people either be charged or released in real courts, it would come out. And that it would so kind of disembowel his intelligence services and his military that he feels, and I think, you know, reasonably, I don't think it's the right decision, but he would not be able to function as president because the military and the CIA would be dealing with so many lawsuits or prosecutions. So there's a strong incentive for him to sweep it under the rug. I think that this is scarier in a way, even scarier than where we got to with Bush, because Obama has floated, and his spokesman let slip to me that it's a fait accompli, this idea of preventive detention, which is more than Bush ever claimed to be able to do, though he had the power to do it. You know, Obama's saying, let's just lock some of these people up forever with no trial. And the reason, I think, again, has to do with what happened to them. It's my best understanding that, you know, if they were to say, well, I was anally probed, you know, 150 times, or they left me out all night, or they covered me with wasps, or worse, you know, now we know that worse was done, it would be too destabilizing to a power structure that he relies on. And so his solution is just to, it's like the mad woman in the attic, you know, just keep, it really reminds me of what they used to do to women in the 19th century who had been raped or been victims of incest, and that they would just say they were crazy or too dangerous to release, and they would lock them up forever, lest their story come out. That's my best reading. What do you think?
I think that, you know, I think one of the things when I tell people what to do, I just think one thing you have to do is not give this new administration a pass on the issues you're raising, on the issues of force feeding at Guantanamo, on the issue of Guantanamo, and particularly on the one you just talked about, which is preventive detention, and for me, military commissions, and I'm sure you as well. And I agree with your underlying point, which is that when they're going to be done now by the Obama administration, in some ways it's going to be much worse than the Bush administration, because it's putting a legal imprimatur on it that Bush never really had the ability to do. It's very bad going forward.
Give us your website, will you, so we can link to it?
Sure. It's NaomiWolf.org, and I also run a kind of ongoing discussion of these issues on my Facebook page, my Facebook fan page. But can I say what people can do?
Yes,
on
my sure.
What I
do.
Always say is, you know, concretely, well, first educate your neighbors. I mean, I really think we have to, each of us, take on the responsibility the founders intended, that, you know, it's up to us to defend liberty and not leave it to the hardworking people in that studio or in, you know, CCR, the other rights organizations. But it's actually the case that there are like three channels and five organizations that are literally the warriors for our freedom, not just the freedom of these people in Guantanamo, but our own, and they're so directly linked. So if you throw a party, you know, a rights party, and, you know, we're making kits that you can get through the Progressive Book Club to get the materials to educate your friends and neighbors, make it a fundraiser for Law and Disorder and for the Center for Constitutional Rights or the ACLU or Human Rights Watch, because these people are literally keeping you and your kids safe and keeping the Constitution safe. And there is, you know, they're doing it with so too few resources and you know, working all night, and, you know, they need so much more than they have to tackle the job that is before them. And they really are working night and day for us. So, and for our kids. So that is number one. I mean, that is really concretely something important you can do.
Well, Naomi Wolf, really, thank you for going to Guantanamo, being there and doing all of this work over the years. So it's terrific to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Want to have you back again, Naomi, and good luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we also want to bring you more twists and turns in how difficult it is to get anybody out of Guantanamo, whether it was under Bush or now under Barack Obama. We're going to be speaking with Jonathan Heifetz, the lawyer for Mohammed Jawad. When you hear the twists and turns in this case, you will be shocked. A 12 or 13-year-old boy picked up in Afghanistan, allegedly for throwing a grenade, tortured, confesses under torture, eventually, because of that, turned over to the Americans, taken to Bagram at its worst period, taken to Guantanamo, tortured all the time, then brought before a military commission. That whole proceeding went by the wayside because of the evidence of torture. Despite that, the administration tried to continue holding Jawad. Finally, at a habeas corpus hearing, the judge said, "That's it. The only evidence here is from torture. I'm going to release this guy." The government then finally says, well, okay, you can issue an order, but we're going to continue criminally investigating him because maybe we want to prosecute him in the United States. We'll see. Hopefully, this will be the end in the next week or two of the nightmare for Mohammed Jawad, a 12-year-old boy tortured and detained for the best part of his childhood from 12 to 19 years old. Jonathan Heifetz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, great to be here.
Jonathan, you've had some extraordinary cases in the post-9/11 era, in the so-called War on Terror. One of them, of course, was the Al-Mari case, which went to the Supreme Court, or almost argued in the Supreme Court by you, and then the government pulled, well, I guess you could call it a fast one in a way, but to avoid a decision on preventive detention, indicted Mr. Al-Mari. And now you have another case that's also raising some major constitutional issues in the United States, or in Guantanamo, rather, at the present moment, and that's Mr. Jawad's case. Why don't you tell us about the background of that?
Yeah, certainly. Mohammed Jawad was a young boy when he was arrested in Afghanistan. He could have been as young as 12 at the time, certainly no more than 15 or 16 when he was arrested in Afghanistan in December of 2002. He was arrested, basically accused of throwing a grenade in a crowded marketplace near Kabul that injured two U.S. service members, who since recovered, and their Afghan interpreter. Following his arrest, he was basically beaten and tortured by corrupt Afghan police at the police station. They obtained a false confession from him, handed him over to the Americans.
One second, Jonathan. They got a false confession of him, claiming he threw the grenade, right?
Right, right. Exactly.
And they did that also with physical stuff, but they also did some mental kind of torture on him. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things they did was they threatened to kill him and kill his family if he didn't confess. In addition to the sort of false confession, oral confession, they also obtained a false written confession where they essentially made him, you know, put his thumbprint on a piece of paper that they told him was his release papers, but was instead a confession to committing the attack, which was written in a language that he didn't even speak.
That's amazing. And this is when he was either 12 or 13, whatever age.
Yeah,
And it was carried out by the Afghans. As far as we know, were the U.S. people present during it, or he was just turned over afterwards?
No, they weren't present during the initial arrest and interrogation. He was turned over later that day or evening to U.S. officials who told the U.S. officials, the Afghan officials told the U.S. officials that this is the guy who did it. You know, we have his confession, and sort of handed him over as the guilty party. That day, that evening, and into the next morning, the U.S. officials continued the torture and the abuse, threatening Mr. Jawad, physically abusing him, and really basically terrifying him, and obtained a second a confession from him, which interestingly was totally different than the false confession that had been obtained by the Afghans.
Now, what year was this, Jonathan?
December 17th of 2002.
So the U.S. gets a different confession, but is it still essentially saying I threw the grenade?
Or? Yeah, it's a different false confession from, wrung out of him through torture. And based on that, they sent him to Bagram, the Bagram, U.S. prison at Bagram in Afghanistan, where he was held for almost 2 months. And, it's important to point out that when Mohammed Jawad, this young boy, goes to Bagram, it was the height of abuse. I mean, it was the sort of worst moments in Bagram's, terrible history. He arrived just days after one of the two detainees at Bagram had been beaten to death by U.S. guards. One of them, a guy named Dilawar, was the subject of the Academy Award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. So Bagram was a horrific place where some of the worst abuses of the so-called war on terror were carried out. And Mr. Jawad was subjected to, intense and brutal treatment there, which has been documented by an Army criminal investigation report. I mean, he was physically abused, pushed downstairs, given sleep deprivation, held in isolation, threatened. It would be a gross mistreatment for even an adult, but for someone who is a young boy, it was just completely unconscionable. While he was at Bagram, the decision was made to send him to Guantanamo, so to legally take him from his country and render him halfway across the world to Guantanamo. He arrived in Guantanamo in February of 2003. He was immediately isolated, in total isolation for a month. And after that, the harsh interrogation measures against him began. And his mental state became so precarious that one of the interrogators said, hey, what's going on? We're getting concerned. This kid's just like staring at the wall all day. And this was in the fall of 2003. So rather than trying to address the situation and rectify the situation, the people who were implementing the interrogation policy at Guantanamo saw this as an opportunity to totally break him. And basically there's a assessment by this BISCIT program. It's basically the psychologists who were complicit in the torture of Guantanamo, which just sought to, use this to kind of break him and destroy him. And just a few months later, he attempted suicide by banging his head against the wall. And fortunately, he recovered, but the abuse continued. Thereafter, he was subject to a notorious frequent sleep deprivation program called the Frequent Flyer Program, where he was basically moved 110 times in a 2-week period to prevent him from sleeping, which caused him to suffer serious, you know, physical and mental harm and damage. Again, just the continued threats, exploiting his longing for his family. A period of time, he was crying for his mother.
It's really a mind-chilling story. I mean, I've heard some of it, but not in that kind of detail, Jonathan. Now, when did you first start getting involved as his lawyer?
Well, I didn't get involved until, until 2009, till this year in the habeas corpus challenge. But there have been a number of, you know, incredibly talented, dedicated military lawyers who have been involved for a long time. Major David Fracht, Major Eric Montalvo, Lieutenant Commander Catherine Doxakis, who served as the defense counsel to Mr. Jawad when they tried to prosecute him.
He was referred to a military commission a couple of years ago, right?
Exactly. He was prosecuted in a military commission in 2007 and 2008. The prosecution sort of saw, you know, Mr. Jawad as, you know, the sexy case, you know, one of their, an easy case, one of their, you know, blockbuster cases, which I think, you know, speaks volumes about everyone else at Guantanamo, and tried to prosecute him for, you know, what they considered a war crime, you know, throwing a grenade at U.S. service members. And, you know, they had two overarching problems, legal and factual. The first was legal. You know, what the judge concluded is that these accusations did not amount to a war crime, throwing a grenade at a armed member of the of another invading force is not a, it's not itself a war crime, you know, even if the person who commits that is not a uniformed soldier.
Yeah, I so found that remarkable charge. I mean, when you think about the case, apart from the fact that he's 12 and they tortured him.
Exactly, exactly. And so it basically eviscerated the government's case. And they, you know, basically recognized that unless, you know, with that ruling, they could not prosecute him. The other was the factual, issues, the fact that they didn't have any credible or reliable evidence and were relying almost exclusively on these false confessions that had been obtained for torture. And in fall of 2008, the military judge threw out the confessions that Mr. Jawad made to Afghan officials and U.S. officials following his arrest as the product of torture. So by the end of the fall of 2008, the government's military prosecution was literally on life support, and it would have been, you know, ended at the time, but then the commissions were suspended by President Obama when he took office in 2009, regrettably to be, you know, revived later. But at that point, you know, Mr. Jawad's commission case was sort of put on ice, but he remained, you know, locked up in legal limbo at Guantanamo, you know, entering his seventh year of detention. So we pressed forward in his separate habeas corpus challenge in federal court, challenging his detention. And that's the point that, you know, I became involved and worked with the Major David Fracht, his military lawyer, to secure his release in the habeas case.
And that's an extraordinary hearing that occurred. That hearing just took place a couple of weeks ago. And I obviously, and most of us involved in Guantanamo, have read the judge's extraordinary ruling. But why don't you give us some sense of what happened in that courtroom?
Yeah, I mean, the case was, you know, sort of being, you know, delayed. The government had tried to effectively, you know, delayed the case. But then in April 2007, the case was administratively reassigned to Judge Ellen Huvel, a district judge, who immediately looked at the case and, you know, heeded the Supreme Court's call in its 2008 Boumediene decision for prompt habeas hearings and, you know, basically said we're going to move forward on the case. So, you know, right at the outset, we said, you know, half a dozen times in court to the government, you know, look, you're relying on evidence that's been obtained through torture. You're in defending this habeas case, you're putting forward the same evidence that the military judge had thrown out as the product of torture.
And this was under the Obama administration, is that right?
This was under the Obama administration. Now, how high up in the administration, you know, our message got, I don't know, but certainly the attorneys that were litigating the case for the Department of Justice, they knew. Judge Huvel gave them opportunity to, you know, revise their defense and or their claims and to say, you know, what are you going to rely on here that you're going to be able to prove to me in court to hold this young man? But they continued, you know, month after month to cling to this evidence that had been obtained by torture and other mistreatment. You know, we termed a motion to suppress the evidence. We said to, you know, we filed this motion saying, you know, evidence obtained by torture and other abuse and coercion is just not admissible in a federal court. It's not admissible for two reasons. One, it's inherently unreliable. And two, it undermines, you know, it goes against the morality of our system and undermines the integrity of our court proceedings. the government then was ordered to respond, and the day that their response was due in before Judge Chauvel, and this was on or around July 15th, they filed something, just a short notice, saying they were not opposing our motion, effectively conceding that, you know, Mr. Jawad had been tortured and that the evidence against him was inadmissible. The judge, you know, promptly issued an order, you know, suppressing all of Mr. Jawad's statements, and then the government ordered the government, you know, to and the parties to come to court to move forward. At this point, the government then, you know, tried to delay again, saying, you know, it needed, you know, additional weeks to figure out its case and to decide how it was going to move forward. You know, Judge Chauvel rightly was enraged and said, you know, this man, young man, has been locked up for almost 7 years. Your entire case has been gutted, and you need to come to terms with that. And I'm not going to delay the hearing. And so she scheduled a hearing for August 5th, basically to have a hearing on the merits, decide whether Jawad should be detained or not. And, you know, before that, she ordered the government to produce any additional information, you know, it wanted to provide, and some, you know, pretrial briefs, as it were. And before the hearing rolled around, lo and behold, the government submitted a notice to the court saying it was no longer going to treat Mr. Jawad as a subject of military detention. It essentially was abandoning its claim that he was an enemy combatant or could be held at Guantanamo.
So they essentially were admitting they had nothing but torture evidence to use against him.
That's correct.
So the big question is, why isn't he out free today?
Well, the judge then granted his petition for habeas corpus, ordered he be released. The delay, which is basically a close to 3-week delay, has to do with this provision enacted by Congress recently, which says that before transferring a detainee from Guantanamo to another country, the president must provide a notice to Congress, you know, explaining an assessment of the prisoner's dangerousness, where he's going, and any conditions on his release. I think this provision should not have been applied to Mr. Jawad and is unconstitutional.
I think it's an unconstitutional provision. That doesn't mean we'd win, but it certainly sounds there's no evidence to hold him, and Congress can pass a law saying, well, you have to hold him until you notify us with 2 weeks' notice or something?
Exactly.
Jonathan, have you had a chance to actually meet him face-to-face?
I did. I met with him earlier last week. I was down in Guantanamo.
Tell us what that was like.
But at that point, this was right after the government conceded that he wasn't properly detained, and so they moved him to Camp Iguana, which has less restrictive conditions. He's able to have sort of freedom of movement, but I would underscore, you know, he's still in prison. You know, he's still locked up behind barbed wire and is still a prisoner of the United States. I think he was, hopeful, cautiously optimistic, based on what we told him, that his nightmare was going to soon be over and that he would be able to return to his family. And, you know, despite the horrible abuse he's been through, he has a remarkably positive attitude. And, you know, at this point, he just wants to get on with the rest of his life, having lost more than a third of it in illegal detention at Guantanamo.
Isn't there an attempt now by the government to say they want to examine whether he might be able to be tried in a criminal court in the United States? Is that serious or is something? What is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. When the government conceded that he was illegally detained at Guantanamo, they notified the court that the Attorney General had directed an investigation of Mr. Jawad to see whether he could be prosecuted in a federal court. As far as we know, the investigation is ongoing, but I think there's just simply no way any fair-minded prosecutor would bring an indictment. One of the most important things is the government would be basically charging him for the same conduct that it was not able to prove in the habeas corpus case, or that chose not to try to prove in the habeas corpus case, where the standard of proof and evidence are looser than in a criminal trial. And all this would be to kind of prolong, you know, the sort of inevitable, I think, which is that, there simply is no reliable evidence that Mr. Jawad did anything wrong, that he threw the grenade or committed any crime, and that he is he should be returned to Afghanistan.
Have they allowed him to speak with his mother or father or relatives, any visitors, anything like that?
No, I don't believe he has been allowed to speak at this point, you know, with his family. I think there's been some letters, but those are very slow and redacted. I think now that he's been moved to Camp Iguana, he will be permitted a family call. I'm not sure if one has occurred yet, but for the nearly 7 years he was held there, like other Guantanamo detainees, you know, not allowed calls.
Jonathan, I want to get your perspective. What do you think is going on in the administration? I mean, they not only made you go all the way up to the edge on the torture testimony before they finally dropped that and even wanted more time, but now that they're actually thinking about a criminal investigation in the United States, and or they're doing that, and want to, where's the push coming from? This is, kid was 12 or 13. It's obviously a false confession. It was a grenade. If it was thrown by anybody, it was thrown in a military context. Well, how do you explain it is really what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to explain. I mean, I think the most charitable interpretation is they just want to, you know, make sure that the new administration wants to make sure they've just thoroughly looked at everything, but that they don't really have any intention, you know, to prosecute Mr. Jawad. I think that, you know, the other sort of charitable interpretation is that the people that President Obama has put in to change detainee policy, you know, may not have been aware of what was going on in terms of the reliance on evidence gained by torture. But I think, you know, the test is, you know, will they continue to rely on coerced evidence in other cases, or are they only going to, you know, sort of abandon it when they're on the verge of getting hammered by a federal court and, you know, called into account? I think the change has been, you know, far too little and far too slow. And I think this case, you know, underscores it in terms of how long it took the government to come to grips that it has no case, and also how even now it seems to be, you know, at least contemplating ending what is clearly an illegal detention and prolonging the kind of nightmare for this young boy.
I mean, 7 years of a 12-year-old boy's life. From 12 to 19, that's extraordinary. I mean, those are the years when you establish your personality, when you think about your life.
How could he ever be normal after this? Yeah. You really are charitable, Jonathan. I would be less charitable. I would say that there's more continuity than discontinuity between the Bush and the Obama administrations, and this is the proof of it.
Certainly there's evidence of that in this case and the other things. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think also troubling is the sense of not really kind of treating the federal habeas proceedings in our judiciary as a little bit of a sideshow, and that the, you know, decisions about release still being made, you know, by the executive. And I think that's very problematic, and just not submitting in letter and in spirit to the rule of law and to our court system.
Jonathan, do you have a website that we can put up for people who want to know more or people who want to try to help on this?
We have a page about Mr. Jawad's case at our website, www.aclu.org.
Excellent.
It's an extraordinary case. I mean, it has everything.
It does, and I think it shows, you know, but this is not the only one. There's so many cases where you just have these people held without evidence, mistreated, you know, for so long.
Well, thank you, Jonathan.
Okay, thanks. Great to be with you.
Yeah, so long.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
use that so much, yeah.